In 1982, George Guthridge took a teaching job in Gambell, Alaska. About the time he got there, he was told he couldn't teach there. It wasn't that he wasn't going to be allowed. It was that the kids were violent, the town was an asylum, nobody wanted to learn, and there wasn't a chance that he could do any good. Well, what George Guthridge discovered in Gambell was a classroom filled with students, filled with academic potential. They proved their potential in terms of excellence by taking statewide competitions just 2 years later and then besting all comers in a nationwide competition. Same kids. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. Join me today as we talk with teacher and writer George Guthridge. George, welcome.
Thank you.
My first question is a statement. There can't have been two Gambells. Was the Gambell that you found anything like the Gambell that the detractors presented to you?
Well, the detractors, one thing they presented was, they said, well, out there the kids are all passive and they'll just sit around and they won't want to learn. And about the middle of the year they'll come down with cabin fever. And really what it was two sides of the same coin. People weren't looking at, these were kids who would go in the basketball court and play till they dropped. These were extremely, extremely competitive kids. The same kids who would not bother take my tests or would never study, would study in 100 hours of homework, often while they're out in the boats, studying while they're rowing and all, for the state competition, because they have the desire to win. That desire to win goes back 4,000 years on St. Lawrence Island, because they've been competing with the Siberian Yupiks all those years. The Siberians would come over, and they would have, they had a long history of warfare there, and after that slowly resolved itself, the Siberians would come over and they would have games. So they're very athletic, very, very competitive, and aggressively competitive people on St. Lawrence Island. And that seems to be true. There's a lot of myths about the Eskimos, because the same seemed to be true when I went to the mainland villages. And I think we see what we want to see.
I want to, during the course of this conversation, talk a good deal about the kids and what happened, how they turned into champions. But I need you first, I think, to set the stage for us. When you and I talked on the phone, and in the book that you're writing called Reversed Instruction, you have talked about something that happened in the 60s where the teaching methods that had gone on before, the ways of learning that had gone on before, were transformed by a political situation. What happened and why?
Well, basically, on the old basics, what we now call the basics approach, or the back to basics approach, we memorized first, and then we familiarized ourselves with the component parts of a picture, and then we saw the bigger picture, and then we were creative. I don't think it was any clear-cut step-by-step process of the four steps, but the point was we memorized first. Unfortunately, what happened was the memorization part was self-defeating. It was very, very boring. Teachers would say, okay, now turn to page 22 and memorize vocabulary, some of which you would never use anyway. So memorization wasn't being used as a powerful tool. It was being used almost as a punishment. About that time, of course, Vietnam happened, and there was this tremendous desire to have relevancy in the classroom. And some of that relevancy resulted in the fragmenting of the curricula, as we already know. But another thing that happened was that there was the idea, if you get kids interested, therefore they will want to learn. Investigation precedes imagination, okay, according to that theory. And things just suddenly turned around. In other words, according to my beliefs, instead of taking and fixing the problem being the memorization part of it, because scores were very, very high, you know, on SATs and ACT scores in the 60s, extremely high. There's never been a time in the history of the United States like it. If we'd fixed that part, I think we would have gone along on an even keel. Instead, we threw the baby, to use a cliche, we threw the baby out with the bathwater and started all over. And with the idea that kids would really want to learn. We had Summerhill as the final end of the spectrum on that. And it just didn't work. You know, no matter how much the kids seemed to like learning, they didn't learn, because the scores proved that. The scores started declining around 1970, and they got more and more dramatic decline as time went on.
And that same original fault, the lack of functional learning that went along with this kind of wrong-headed memorization, added itself to inability to compete scholastically?
Yes, because look what we had. We suddenly had memorization at the end, if at all. Yeah. And so what we were saying to kids subconsciously was, you don't really need to learn for the test. Learning is just fun. We'll just have a little bit of memorization, take the test and forget, because it was always put at the end if it was put in at all. And also there was a move away from what E.D. Hirsch from University of Virginia called scholastic cultural literacy, which I like to call scholastic literacy, which was that we all need a certain world knowledge to operate from. And there was a movement away from that. And anyway, and many other reasons, the scores began to decline. Now there was a rationalization put out in the 70s, which for a while I bought into it also, is that there was a wider spectrum of kids taking the test. There were a lot of inner city kids, and everybody said, okay, the scores are bound to go down. But then somebody began looking at the top scores. They shouldn't go down. It doesn't matter who's taking the test, the top scores should stay equal, even or go up. And they didn't. They were in dramatic decline as well. And so suddenly, even today, where we used to be the economic, not only economic leader in the world, but the academic leader in the world, now in a recent survey, for example, a recent international test in science, we managed to beat Jordan and Ireland of 17 top nations in the world. Even tests in English, when we go up against the Russians and the Japanese, we lose. Even in English, we don't do well. It's very sad.
Striking. This is George Guthridge. Our guest today on Conversations has been teaching for nearly 20 years. He teaches currently at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Bristol Bay campus in Dillingham. Before that, the years which allowed him to develop his method of teaching called reversed instruction were spent at Aneguin High School in Elam, Alaska, and then earlier than that at Apangaluk High School in Gamble. He started, as I said, in Gamble in 1982. His kids, who had dreadful scholastic problems in 1982, you said the school was threatened with closing.
School was threatened with closure in spring of 1982.
Took national and statewide championships 2 years later. George Guthridge, our guest on Conversations. I think that isolates the problem. You've described it very well. You described to me on the phone a method of learning which you said works. I don't want you to tell the whole story at once, but an example you gave to me just became indelible, and that's how an Eskimo child learns to hunt. Can you show how that happens, and then we'll talk later about why that works for everyone else?
Okay, an Eskimo boy learning to hunt goes out with his father or grandfather or his uncle, and according to accepted belief, he watches, but I don't believe that. He memorizes. Because you can take that same kid and put him in the classroom, let him watch all he wants, and he won't duplicate the experience. Okay, he memorizes what they're doing. And he's quiet. There's cultural reasons. There's also reasons because of the animals, of course. But he's very quiet, and he memorizes. That's the first thing he does. Next, he familiarizes himself with the tools until the gun, and in case of Gamble, the slingshot was basically a part of their arm. Third, then they begin seeing the big picture. Then they begin thinking about the relationship of the weather and the ice to the animals. And someone said they began thinking like an animal in a good sense of the word, in good sense of the term. And then if they survive, okay, then they become creative. Okay, so look what they've done. They've established a foundation of knowledge, okay, upon which to build slowly build that sense of conceptualization and finally creativity. But when we teach kids, we have so much emphasis on being creative that system, that Eskimo system, so to speak, is the other way around. And I always ask people, would you buy a house from somebody who filled with the foundation, didn't bother to put one in, or just said, oh, let's be creative with the foundation and put anything we want in and have fun with it? Would you buy that house?
Well, no, but yes, people have, of course. You've described,
I had a couple myself.
You've described this as a Daniel Boone philosophy. What does that mean?
Okay, well, Daniel Boone actually said, be sure you're right, then go ahead. That phrase was later taken by Fess Parker when he played Davy Crockett. So a lot of people think Davy Crockett said it, but he didn't. And what's that saying is, if you're out on the ice, if you're going to be try and try again, which is the philosophy I call the city philosophy or the Franklinesque philosophy, the philosophy of most of American education today, you very likely will die. because one mistake will kill you. If it's 30 below on the ice with a wind chill of 100 below.
You don't get it right the first time. You don't get a second chance.
And then I make a thing, well, that's not just true of the Eskimo. That's true of anybody in what I call a rural situation. And a rural situation doesn't have to be in the country. A rural situation is any place, any time, any event in which a mistake will kill you physically or financially, or you know, greatly impede what you're doing, obviously. So where there's a lot at stake, okay? But what we have in a city with try and try again philosophy is that we have a lot of lawyers.
Because there's lots of mistakes.
Lot of mistakes. And we have things like Challenger and Chernobyl at the end of the spectrum.
Okay. That's your argument. Now tell me how that might work if you wanted to teach me English. Not a life or death situation. I can make mistakes and still survive. I may get a hot dog instead of a hamburger. I may go through a stop sign or a slow sign. I may fail to read the signs on the road, but...
But it is a life or death situation. It's your academic life. It's your educational life. And as teachers, we have students in class only a finite amount of time, approximately 6 to 7 hours a day, and during which they're only on task, you know, some percentage of that. So very important thing. Okay, the way that works is I try to isolate the things which I feel as an experienced teacher, as a professional, that in the unit I'm teaching, that you absolutely need to know for lifelong retention. What do you absolutely need to know? Okay. And since obviously there's a tremendous number of things in any unit, I've tried to get it down, and with people beginning with reverse instruction, I say 10, what we call kernels. A kernel is a concept which you absolutely need to know.
Kernels, K-E-R.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Good.
Our popcorn kernels, right. In there. Okay. And that becomes the foundation. Now you're going to, what you do is you define those kernels in 7 words or less. Okay. The reason why you have 7 words is because there's about 7 integers, let's say, that make up of anything that's easy to remember. That's why you have 7 numbers in your telephone.
Okay.
That's right. Also, we use a theory developed in Bulgaria to teach the memorization, and called Suggestopedia, now called Superlearning in America. So we use the high-powered, fun, exciting memorization techniques to teach it, and it just happens that approximately 7 words is about what you can say in 4 seconds. And that and Superlearning suggests that we do most of our teaching in intervals of 4 seconds or less. Okay.
Because
with a break.
Why? Because my mind wanders off after that time?
Because during the superlearning phase, we have kids close their eyes and relax. Why relax? Simply because that's when you learn the best. That's what an athlete does. Okay. Why close your eyes? Because we don't want anything. We want the minimum number of inputs coming in. And there's a step-by-step process that I teach. And we have kids. Now, that's not big breath. It's a normal breath. They breathe in for 2 seconds, hold for 4, breathe out for 2, 2, 4, 2. Okay, it just happens that in all the studies that have been done, you know, certain types of music help you learn better. Well, it just happens that Baroque music is the music that's been identified that helps you learn the best, and Baroque Largo is a music which happens to have a 4-4 beat.
Okay.
I don't know anything about music, but there is the breathing pattern, 2-4-2, 4-4, okay? And so they get the intervals of 4 because when you're holding your breath, nothing else physiological to speak of is going on. Or put it this way, you've minimized the physiological processes. Okay, so all they're getting the lexical. They're getting this unit, this purified unit, which you very, very carefully have defined. In other words, you're not going to take these 10 concepts and take the book and define them. You're going to define them as succinctly and powerfully as you possibly can. Okay, when you teach the ten. Okay, so, and also I found when you have the kids with their eyes closed, you obviously worry about where they fall asleep. Well, the breathing pattern, it's an abnormal breathing pattern. It's slightly faster, keeps the brain awake. The eyes are closed, the brain says, oh, time to go to sleep. But then the breathing pattern goes a little bit faster and it says, oh, I'm supposed to be getting information. And the results are phenomenal. The results of super learning. Now, again, this is just one component of what I'm doing. It's sort of a catalyst at a certain point, is that there's 85% in retention lifelong. 85%. You can teach, for example, 400 vocabulary words in one day with 85% retention. Now think what you can do when those are concepts rather than just vocabulary.
Through this process of harnessing the physiology, and it's not intellect, it's receptivity,
It's receptivity, that's exactly right. Okay, it's because you want to establish this foundation of knowledge, and you want to get it as pure and as possible, the most, the finest refined ingredients, shall we say, and then go ahead and establish it as make it as strong as you possibly can.
Okay. Let me reintroduce you, and then don't let me forget that what I want to ask is about relevance. George Guthridge is with us today. He is currently writing a book titled Reversed Instruction. It's based on his experiences since he began teaching high school in Gamble and since that time in other schools, both at the at the high school level and at the college level. Reversed Instruction was a book bought and paid for by the U.S. Department of Education. It's going to go out to bid for public publishers in the next couple of weeks. Reversed Instruction will also include software for teachers. George Guthridge is also the author of co-author of Child of the Light, which is a very different book, a fiction based on fact about three protagonists in the Holocaust. George Guthridge, both a writer and a teacher with us. Now, glad I didn't forget. One of the problems you said was associated with memorization in the 60s before this transformation of teaching and learning in American schools was that memorization wasn't relevant. We learned as youngsters things that were of no earthly use. How do you transform that in reversed instruction?
Because reverse instruction allows the teacher to select and refine main concepts he or she wants to teach. And so they're not just saying open the textbook. Okay, and there's a step-by-step process that I teach the teachers that helps them understand what should they refine, what should they select. And it's actually a grading system where they can take any amount of information, grade it, and then select for the best.
Does this work for science, math, English, skills for how to live in my village, whether it's enormous, New York City, or minute, Gamble?
When I first started teaching it, I thought it only worked for teaching of writing, which is my specialty. The more I taught it, and the more the other people have borrowed from it and used it, the wider applications it seems to have. We had somebody used it in preschool. We had parents be on the phone. How are my kids learning so much? My 3 and 4 year olds. How are they learning so much? We've used it in graduate school. We've used it across the board in disciplines. Everything from voc ed to I've used it in PE, for example. And, another person has a similar. It was independent between us. Is a man from Berkeley who works with the Top Gun School in the United States Air Force. Top Gun School used a similar program. It's not quite so step-by-step as mine, but by golly, when the person's in the aircraft, they want 99% of that to be not rote, okay, but ingrained. There's a big difference there, okay? Rote, not...
Felt in the hands as the hands reach for the tool.
So that you only have 1% where you have to make life or death decisions. You don't want to have to be groping around and make all kinds of mental corrections as you're flying. So what are you there? You're creative where it counts, instead of saying, okay, kids, let's go out and be creative.
Now, take us back to Gamble. I assume you walked into a classroom full of kids who didn't expect much of anything from you and didn't expect much of anything from themselves. How did this sort out? I don't want 25 words or less, but not the entire book.
Right. It sort of happened because I was in a new situation. I did have some things going for me that I think other teachers didn't. I had taught writing many, many, many times. I was very familiar. I was very comfortable. I knew what I knew well. I also seemed to fit into the village very easily. People ask me, well, did you have a great deal of cultural shock? I had no cultural shock whatsoever. I had cultural shock when I moved to Montana, Iowa. That was cultural shock. In my day-to-day living, I'm very, very shy. I'm very quiet. For me, the classroom is where I'm like a fish in water. And I'm completely at home in the classroom. I'm not outside the classroom, like a lot of writers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the kids feel that, okay? And also, I don't push kids. I pull them. I think of teaching as an ace. It just happens. A lot of things I do has to do with card playing, I think. But the word ace, and A stands for advent, and C stands for competence, and E stands for excellence. For me, that means ultimate excellence. What's the final thing? If you had a short story a high school kid was writing, what do you really mean by excellence? For me, it's being published nationally. That's an objective criteria, and that's an ultimate excellence.
Okay? You took that into Gamble.
I took that into Gamble. That's right. And in a lot of the learning we see, in fact, is one of the problems. Now, I'm a real advocate of master learning and of outcome-based education. Don't get me wrong. But one of the real problems...
Those are two, everyone might not know, prominent theories of
education.
Right.
They're right now at the forefront of education and basically saying we need to identify our outcomes before we start teaching.
Okay.
And be very clear on that. But unfortunately, a lot of our outcomes are being defined as competence. Now, I found when I started teaching, because I taught the same class over and over and over, I've taught composition as near as I could tell 86 times, it was easier to teach a person to get an A than to get a C. It was easier for me to take a bonehead comp student and teach him how to write a paper that would get him an A or B every time on junior level or above on the graduate level. And to prove that, I used to take the papers because I couldn't believe the papers I was getting when I started with this theory that I was developing. I used to take them to the graduate school and drop them off and say, will you grade these? And 60% would come back as A's and B's. Graduate level. These were for freshmen.
Huh.
Because I found it was to save my own life because I had 120 students. I met every student every week. Okay, to save my own psychology or whatever and my own sanity, I wanted to see how could I develop a program that would allow me to get past all the problems, because the same kids would come in and I could say, okay, out of 120 kids, there'll be four major problems, and they'll fall into one of the four. So I became a parrot, you know. I was losing my mind by the second year of teaching, and so I said, I have to do something better. And so I began teaching this ultimate expression of writing, what I do naturally. I began, and I went back and I said, is there a step-by-step process I can achieve that end, in which each step is concrete? To give you an example, I've seen over 600 books on how to write in the first 3 years I taught. I happened to be the librarian for the department, so I got them all. And I would thumb through it. I never found one that could tell you a step-by-step process to get a limited topic. I developed one, and it works. And it works so well that after the second year I taught it, I could walk into a classroom and I say, if you do exactly what I say and do it the best of your ability, I will show you how to write a research paper in 2 days, including all of the research, and you will never get less than a B. Never. And they began doing that. I had a lot of kids that were real excited about my classes.
Lots okay. to learn and proof
a step
of
by
learning.
Step, right, and a proof of learning. And they started producing these papers. And it's, again, it's a step-by-step process. And I see it as what I call a yellow brick road. It's like a railroad. I kind of cheat here because I know they didn't really have a railroad in Wizard of Oz. But it's like a railroad, so you have speed.
Speed.
You know, efficiency with the track. But under the track is a tie, a series of steps. Now, if you're walking down the tracks, I used to do that a lot when I was a kid. You know, you can walk along the rail, but at the same time, you could walk down the ties, and it's kind of hard to walk. It's kind of jarring, okay? But you're always cognizant of those ties, okay? Those are my steps. Each one is concretely expressed. So I don't just say, this is a limited topic, and generally go get one. I show you exactly how to get that. And then I move you from the tie onto the rail.
Okay. Now, with the students in Gamble, what led you to the notion of a competition? Were they doing so well that you wanted to prove them to the rest of the world? Or did you leash the competition that was 4,000 years old that we mentioned at the top of this program?
Well, in terms of the scholastic competitions, we need to start there. I knew nothing about the process of future problem solving. I had never heard of it before. Future problem solving was invented by Dr. Paul Torrance from the University of Georgia, and he's sort of the guru of gifted education.
And this relates to the kind of competition
this,
the kids were going to go to.
He developed this competition to pull in kids who tend to be very shy.
Okay.
A lot of gifted kids, they get frowned on in the classroom because their ideas are so off the wall, so they shut up. Okay, and he was worried about those kids. Well, this competition had grown over the years. This was now, when I started, it was in the eighth year of the competition, and involved around 100,000 students in 14 countries. Now it's much bigger. Okay. And I made the comment one day, opened my big mouth, and I said, how come the resource teacher or the special ed teacher spends so much time with the resource kids, the lower kids, what's what we call the resource kids, and no time whatsoever with these kids who seem to be college bound. We had some real sharp kids in Gamble who'd been just sort of passed over. They'd been, for example, 2 years before I was there, and the kids told me this. I didn't go snooping around. The kids said, we sat in class and our teacher started on the taught wonderfully from the 15th of August or 22nd of August to approximately the 15th of October. Then he showed us movies every day, all day, and often the same movie over and over. That was their education. They'd had no education. So here were these kids who they were rare and eager to go, but there was a light in those eyes, you know. And I made that comment. Well, my principal, a very good principal, and he said, well, would you want mine, because I taught college for a number of years before that, he said, would you mind teaching a class and getting the kids ready for college? You know, because a special ed teacher she's just too busy and can't do both. I said, sure, no problem. And the next thing I knew, he gave me a notebook about the size of the house, and it was called Future Problem Solving. And they said, you're going to put him in the future problem? I saw him in competition. I said, I don't know what this is, you know. And they said, well, you're going to be trained in it, and we'll send you to Anchorage. Now, I said, oh, Anchorage, okay, I'm going to go shop. Okay, so I said, okay, I'll do it. Well, I never really got any training because the plane broke down on the way, so I invented my own training, and I was helped by a woman named Mary Rubidoux, who's now, I think, deputy superintendent in Kenai School District, Kenai Borough. But at the time, she'd had a team the year before from Unalakleet who had gone to state competition. I believe they were the first team ever had rural natives on it ever to make the state, and they came in. I think they came in third, although there is technically no third place. You know, it was only first and second.
Let me pause long enough to remind you that this is George Guthridge. We're talking about taking kids from Gamble to statewide and then national competition, and this is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis.
Okay, so what I did was, I suddenly had these students. In fact, it was crazy. I mean, it was an insane situation because we sat down as a faculty and they said, well, let's put all the kids in. Now, it also included elementary. I also had elementary teams.
How many kids?
At its height, I had 28 kids in one class, and on the other side of the bookcase, I had a kid in algebra, and I'm terrible in math. I had two kids in reading, and at the other end of the school, I had about five kids in journalism, about three kids in basic office management technology, and a couple kids in typing. And you couldn't get from one end of the school to the other without going this huge U-shape things. And everybody's wondering, how come I'm not in my classroom? It's because I was teaching in two classrooms at the same time, and that's why, you know, and I'm a split personality, but there's a limit. And so I said, well, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do this? And so I developed a formula. Okay, now basically, in a nutshell, the process says the kids are given a scenario. All they know is they're going to be given, a topic. Like, the kids won on genetic engineering. Okay, the first topic they had was UFOs, and that's all they know. Okay, they don't know anything they're going to be asked. And then when the competition begins, you now have 2 hours, and you work in a team of four. You have 2 hours to identify 20 problems that could probably go wrong in that scenario. Each problem should be a short paragraph to explain the problem.
In a specific scenario under
right.
the heading UFOs
right.
or
and
genetic engineering.
You don't know the scenario until the time is called and they're given it. Okay, and you have to come up with 20 things that could go wrong, and you need to show book research to prove that it probably will go wrong. No books or notes. It's all going to be in your head. Then take one of those 20 problems. Oh, and one other thing. If you want to have any hope of winning whatsoever, you have to identify 20 problems that, in the opinion of the judges, well, not only does nobody else in the competition put in, but also in the opinion of the judges, no one else your age should have thought of. Okay?
It's a real challenge.
To have any hope. Oh, that's just the first step. From there, you then take one of those problems, state it as a problem to be solved in a certain way, then solve it 20 ways. From many different perspectives as you can, again, utilizing known information but solving it in ways that the known information extrapolates to rather than just simply exist. And again, if you have any chance, in those 20 ways, you have to solve it in ways that in the opinion of the judges, no one your age should have thought of. Then come up with five criteria to evaluate any 10 of your 20 solutions, evaluate them, and then write an essay showing how the one you select is the best, most humane, and will help solve the overall problem.
Phew.
In 2 hours. A team operating at its best will produce, a high school team, will produce 44 pages writing every other line in 2 hours.
And that's with of the results, right? This isn't showing our work or anything of the sort.
This is starting from the time the buzzer sounds. You have 2 hours to do all that. So you have to go in with a tremendous amount of knowledge. Now, it occurred to me that I went back to my old philosophy. I had developed a formula for teaching research paper writing. I had developed a formula for teaching article writing. They were all formulas for me. Maybe there could be a formula developed to, at least for the first part, to be able to write about the problem they identify, okay? And the more I got worked with it, the more the formula became sophisticated. So after a while, they could actually identify problems and then prioritize the problems according to certain criteria we worked out as a team, so that they would go into a competition with maybe 300 ideas, but they had them prioritized in their heads. If they ask us this, let's use this one. If they ask us this, let's use this one, see? But they still have to fit exactly, okay? You just can't write anything down. But then I came up with what I call the vertical ace, okay? And the vertical ace is name the problem, all right? This card, not the overall problem, but the problem itself, the little one, name the problem, and then that's part A. Part C, prove it's a problem, and part E, give the bad result. Okay, what do we have there? And I didn't know this until just recently I began thinking about this. We have task analysis, part A, we have part C, substantiation, and we have part D, logic. Because in the logic, I would tell them, they can't repeat part A. In other words, you can't say, finding fuel may be a problem, blah, 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 and therefore we can't find fuel.
Okay? Uh-huh.
So they also couldn't make a mountain out of snow hill, a mountain out of a molehill, which we commonly known as snowballing, which is, say, therefore everybody will die or some disastrous result. Okay, so that was the ACE, A-C-E. Then later on, as my kids got more sophisticated at doing that, we'd plug in a part B. You have A, B, C. B would be define the problem if it wasn't clear, okay? And part D was give a personal experience example or some other example to illustrate your point.
Okay, let's go all the way through.
Okay. A, name the problem.
Name the problem.
And you have task analysis. B, define the problem if necessary. You have definition. C, prove it's a problem using book research. You have substantiation, traditional academic stuff. D, give an illustration, give an example, preferably from personal experience. So you have example. And E, you have logic. Okay. Those five things normally take a teacher at least 2 years to teach. My kids had it from the get-go. I got a call one day from UAF here asking me from somebody teaching English, says, how do your kids write so well? Huh. Okay, there are two reasons. First, my kids wrote essays under high-pressured situation, and they wrote lots of them. If a kid went through my program for 4 years, they wrote 150 essays, little short things, fall into formula, okay? But the other thing, they knew how to use personal experience. There is methods taught today where personal experience is an end in itself, and that is considered the main way of teaching writing in Alaska. I looked at that program in 1969 and saw that it had problems. Personal experience writing is not an end in itself. It has to prove a point.
It's too narrow. Yeah.
So what happens, the kids get here to UAF or any other school, and they'll write, yesterday I did such and such. That's not college level. Or they go out to the workforce. Yesterday I did such. That's not what they need to know. Okay.
Right.
So my kids had this five-part formula. Then I got back in the last couple years. And of course they put in a tremendous amount of time and a tremendous amount of work. And they consulted experts. We used to call up scientists literally all over the country and get advice. And kids got very good at phone conversations and I would help them. Okay. But then I began stepping back. And what do we have here? We have now a formula that we can teach to preschoolers. Name the problem. How do we know it's a problem? What's the bad result? We have, okay? And then we can, in other words, they don't have to write, obviously, but you can teach logic to preschoolers. We have people doing that.
Give me an example for a preschooler and then an example for a high school student so we
can carry
everyone
through. Okay, an example of preschool.
In
Elam, we had a couple of kids who had to wait at the school for their older brothers to pick them up on the four-wheeler.
Okay.
You could teach them, what are some of the problems? You know, and of course you got to do a lot, you know, teachers got to really offer a lot. And one of the problems might be, well, playing on the teeter-totter might be a problem, okay? Why it might be a problem, see? Because the teeter-totter doesn't work very well. What might happen? I could get hurt, okay? high school. Let's say it's a social studies unit, because I've now taken this, when it started out from problem solving, I applied to the classroom, and the results are wonderful. Let's say a social studies unit. You want to talk about, it just happens to be, what, 3 days from now, Christopher Columbus, you know. What you don't want to do is, well, first off, you get a lot of ideas from the kids, okay? And we go for quantity, not quality. Then we go back down through, and we teach the kids, quality means things you feel that nobody else would think of, okay? And we have a grading system for that, and the kids get real good at grading their ideas. So they're going to think of, like, you may run out of water. They're going to think of, well, everybody's going to think of that. Even, okay, but they may not think of the fact that Columbus's math was pretty bad, okay? That takes a little bit of digging. So the fact that Columbus's math was not very good may be a problem, and then you qualify it if we were on a voyage sailing west from Spain, okay? Now prove it's a problem, show his math, show the fact that he thought the world was 8,000 miles around, and really, the reason, by the way, the Portuguese wouldn't let him go is not they thought they were going to fall off the world, and the world, as the world, most people knew the world was round, you know, it's the fact that they knew the world was approximately 25,000 miles in circumference and that they'd all die. That was a thing. Okay, so there's the problem, proves a problem, now give the bad result. Okay, there you go.
Along the way, these kids are learning history, navigation, smattering of at least, geography, something about their culture and other cultures?
That's right, because one thing you build in is what's called flexibility. There are ways that you teach kids to take a look at the scenario that you give as the teacher, from many different points of view, all teacher has to do is run down the college majors. Sociology, okay, problems with people. What kind of problems do you have with people? Biology, okay, communications, blah, 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 right down the list. It's really easy to do, and the kids get real good at it after a while.
Now, you have said to me that your theories, your proven experience with what you've learned and what you've learned, the ways in which you've learned to teach in Gamble and now in Dillingham, has coincidentally dovetailed with some leading theories of learning in the beginning of the 1990s. Where do you think what you're teaching, how you're teaching, and how these other systems work are going to take learning? Is American education going to welcome, or is it going to say, no, we know how to teach. I've been teaching I don't want to change. What's going to happen?
There are a number of things. First off, every teacher I've showed this to practically, when they see the whole program and they start using it at all, they're fascinated with the results because it's so easy. It's so easy to do. The nice thing, it cuts your time. It cuts your time way down.
Those 120 students, writing students.
That's right.
Again.
It cuts your time way down. And the scores start going up, and the kids start responding. Kids start, they really seem to get turned on to education. Education to me is enlightenment and not entertainment. And kids know that. I always often say, if you put Michael Jordan and Michael Jackson in the classroom, you know, these people are the archangels, the Michaels of the young people. They couldn't keep those kids interested day to day. Why do you think you can? Why do you think you can entertain them if they can't? See? Kids get bored.
But it's not entertainment.
It's not entertainment. It's enlightenment, and we forget that. Okay. We have so much emphasis on entertainment that the kids learn the rules of the games, but they don't learn what they're supposed to learn from the game, and when we apply them to the normal classroom. Okay. There is that. There's also been a tremendous move for accountability in teaching because the scores have been so low, you know, and in that accountability, I walk in. When I used to go to in-services, I was always a pariah because I used to raise my hand and ask, and I wasn't trying to be a hard case. I wanted to know, does this work? And have you ever taught in the bush? I think those are legitimate questions. So if you ask me, does this work? I can lay this out for you. It wasn't that they just won two national championships, which, by the way, we think they're the only school in the history of the United States ever win two in 1 year. I taught in an Elam. In the first year of their competition, three girls who had never done it before, with one who happened to be my younger daughter, who had had it for 3 years, they shattered the national record by 70 points. They shattered the national record. It's like winning a basketball game 200-12. They just blew everybody away. Okay, we took the same thing, applied it to the teaching of reading. which I had never taught before. And I have to understand, I have absolutely no background in education. I walked into a couple classes just enough to get my certificate. I just sat in on a couple, didn't attend the classes. I thought they were silly, and I got my certificate. So I have no background. I'm the guy, I taught for 6 years, I thought Bloom's taxonomy, you know, which is the theory of abstraction. I thought that had something to do with biology, with animals. I had no background. Mine's all been seat of the pants, and people say, you know what you're doing? You're doing this, and you're doing this, and you're doing this, which I happen to stumble into by things which worked, okay? So I have these, I have examples. I show the teachers these work. But the other thing which is really nice is in the past several years, with the move towards accountability, we've had what we call mastery learning and outcome-based education, in which they show teachers, there's design down, where they design the whole, try to design the whole curriculum so they know what they want, and then and at the beginning they set up assessments which they teach the kids, this is how we're going to assess you, this is what we're going to assess you on, and then when they get to the end, they assess the kids, they correct them, they teach enrichment, and they reassess, so that you have mastery learning, so hypothetically everybody gets all the skills. Okay, let's say that education with mastery learning, outcome-based education, because they're really two parts of the same thing, one fits within the other, is that that's ABC and XYZ of education.
The beginning and the end.
The beginning and the end. And as somebody said recently, I didn't come up with this, somebody just said, you know what I'm, what you're doing? I'm giving them B to W. I tell them how to get from that point to that point, a step-by-step, four-step process in which each step is very concretely laid out for the teacher, and yet they have tremendous amount of flexibility within that process, and they can also have a tremendous amount of creativity because now they know that their creativity is no longer going to overwhelm the kids' reception of the information. It's always going to help that delivery and not hinder that delivery because it's very, very carefully laid out.
This is George Guthridge. A brief background on our guest today. He took his BA in English from Portland State University in 1970. His MFA was in creative writing and came from the University of Montana in 1972. He has taught in Montana, Oregon, Iowa, and in Alaska. He is currently the Assistant Professor of English and General Studies at UAF's Bristol Bay campus and has been such since 1990. Will they buy your Better Mousetrap?
I think so, because there have been a lot of background, has been a lot of background laid. Also, I've been compared to Jaime Escalante, the star of Stand and Deliver. In fact, our situations are similar. We've talked on the phone. I've written him, and people have pointed out the analogy so many times.
Sure.
That what he did and what I did, and the problems he ran into are very similar to the problems I ran into. Very, very similar. So, in other words, I have somebody I can point to. And if you'll go through, if for people who go through my training, and the last thing I do is I give them Stand and Deliver, which most people have seen. Most people, teachers say, now I say, now study it. Watch what he's doing. And you'll see, he doesn't have the step, you know, but you'll see it's the same thing. Now, I thought I was kidding myself on that until a few years ago, Simon & Schuster hired two ex-teachers, or maybe they approached him. I don't know how it began, but I got a call suddenly, and they said, we've selected you as one of 78 American educators who've had phenomenal success with students, and we'd like to come and interview you. And I said, oh, sure, you know, I thought it was, you know, I'd gotten a lot of calls about that time by newspapers and stuff, many of whom would never call back and stuff like that. So I figured, oh, okay, and I very politely hung up. And all of a sudden they said, we're on our way, a few weeks later, and they interviewed me in Nome. I was the next to last person of all the 78 to be interviewed. And they said, you know, this is very interesting. There are 75 people we've interviewed, and they tend to teach someone alike. And there are two people, and they're way out here. They're doing something totally different, and they're having phenomenal success, and that's you and Escalante.
Huh.
So there's that that's happened. And, of course, the movement in OBE and mastery learning has happened. So as soon as I talk to people now and I say, I can show you how to get from one point to the other, and I can show the teachers how to do it, and I can do it now easily in 2 days, people get real excited real fast, especially when they compare those, they put those together with the results that have already occurred.
And there seems to be sufficient, perhaps is the better word, frustration on a national level as well as on local levels with the teaching and learning that's going on.
We're obviously not doing
timing.
We're obviously not doing things very well.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's not the teacher. You know, most teachers are very, very hardworking, but they're also very frustrated. And I think we need to get back My philosophy, as I said earlier in this program, is that we need to go back to where we were when we were getting the scores. Now, in that, you have to keep in mind that the people who came, the baby boomers, you know, which I pride myself on being a baby boomer, for a number of reasons, some of which simply are numbers, but also because there was a lot of parental input and other factors that went into it, our scores were abnormally high. So you can't say, you know, we keep looking back to the good old days. But we did something. We did turn away from things which work, some very fundamental philosophies that worked right around 1970. We need to get back there. The people who are doing, the cultures who are doing things similarly to what I'm doing, the Japanese, the Koreans, the Taiwanese, the Russians, the Germans, the Swedes, their scores are still way up there. And yet, when I talk to people from the Orient and they go over how they learned, I had a really interesting discussion with somebody from EdChina last summer, and you know, they have a lot of memorization, they do a lot of rote memorization, and what I'm saying is, okay, look at what they're getting out of that. What if we take it, instead of rote memorization and memorizing phenomenal amounts of things, memorize these kernels, memorize the very essence of what you need, okay, and build from there. What would be the results? Because if you take and isolate, let's say on a given unit, if you isolate 75 things you want to teach the kids, they're not going to learn it all. Yeah. I don't care how hard you work. Okay.
Describe your house for me. You said something before we sat down today. You said I sorted it out. I distilled it. The way I teach, the way I think teaching should be done, is like building a house.
Okay.
Tell me.
Well, in a nutshell, a house starts with a foundation. You have to have that foundation absolutely solid.
Memorization.
Okay, but it's more than that. Because when you look at that foundation, you don't know what the house looks like. Unless you're the builder. I mean, somebody else. Okay.
Right.
So when I teach the kernels with this high power memorization, I do something that I've never seen anybody else do. I don't explain them. I just teach them. And they're all a little bit confusing because I believe that confusion is creative. I want the kids to look at that foundation. They know it's important because they've got this high power delivery going on in the classroom. And then I'm going to wait at least a day before I tell them, I start explaining the kernels beyond the seven word definitions.
Okay? I've got words floating around in my head, and so, I'm wondering what they are.
So what happens is that impels you as the student to think for yourself. So that we don't have teacher with all the answers, and we don't have white teacher coming in the village with all the answers, because, boy, that has been a real problem. Okay, so now you have at least a day and sometimes longer before you begin to have an inkling what this is really all about. So when I give you my answers, what I'm doing is validating your experience rather than indelibly coloring it from the outset. Okay, so that's step one. Okay, in other words, the foundation. Step two, again, it's a four-step system. Step two is like the walls of a house, the walls in the roof, the shell. But these are walls to hold in understanding, not hold it out. Okay. To get that kind of understanding, we have to break down the barriers between disciplines. We've pigeonholed kids so much that they would learn. They were learning problem solving. These kids were state champions in problem solving in my classroom, and they went to the next classroom and couldn't solve problems because it was so pigeonholed. So we have to break those barriers down. So how do we do that? Well, it actually is very simple. If you remember, there are 10 kernels. In the 10, what I say is you take your unit and you have to expand the unit. You have to break down the barriers between disciplines. At least one of the kernels has to go to something beyond that. So if let's say your unit is on decimals, then perhaps you have a kernel which shows the use of decimals in money, international monetary exchange, and maybe in sports. The first sub-4-minute mile run by Roger Bannister was in 3:59, whatever it was. Okay, that's a kernel, say. That forces them to go beyond the norm.
Well, better than that, it takes decimals out of the realm of mystery and puts it in
decimals
something
out,
like
that's exactly right. It shows application, but they don't know that yet, see, because they're not explaining it, all right? And in step two, we do training, okay, which it's sort of like being on a job. Step one is knowledge. Step two is training. We teach reading comprehension. We teach math computation. I do, but to do that, I'm showing what Hirsch calls a cultural literacy approach, or I call the scholastic literacy approach. I'm giving you the information. I'm broadening your information. What Hirsch never did, though, was come up with a system of doing it, and that's what I've done. I've taken Hirsch's theory, and I have a system of broadening your reading approach, okay? Because one of the problems in reading, reading just isn't decoding. Reading is a base of knowledge that you need in order to make the associations for comprehension. Otherwise, you don't get that comprehension. You get kids in high school who can decode every word, but they don't know what the story means. They don't know what the chapter in the book means. They have no idea, okay? Because they don't have that base knowledge. So what I've done is come up with a method, a step-by-step method, very easy to implement, that allows you to do that. Now, what I do is I have you teach the reading, what I call the emphasis reading, the reading in the unit. From its own discipline, you teach that during the day. In the evening, you broaden it. They do reading in the evening. And I have a system which the kids do 100% of the reading every night. There's no problem getting the kids to do homework. You don't have to give them Frisbees. You don't have to give them money. You don't have to threaten them. It's real simple. All my kids do all of the reading every night, because when they come back the next day, if they haven't done the reading, they stay after school and they write it out. They either read it or they write it. There are no other alternatives. Okay, so all of the reading gets done. Now, what I've done to make it simplified for teachers to implement it is one of the problems, we have a lot of absenteeism. So if you're reading chapter after chapter of a book, kids are going to get behind. Also, there's no guarantee that all the kids will like the book. There will always be some who hate it. So instead of doing that, take a chapter out of the book, teach the chapter, put the book on the table, and just let it sit there. The rest of the book will disappear, okay? And then what we do is we teach the great books, but simplified often, okay? So that you teach Romeo and Juliet in the third grade by teaching the comic book or whatever, or a synopsis of it, or an excerpt from it.
Some people say that's a scandal.
Oh, I hope so.
What do you mean, you hope so?
I hope that's a scandal.
To disrupt Romeo and Juliet or Great Expectations
because what are we trying to do? Which would you rather have? A kid who walks in the college classroom knowing what Othello was about, knowing what Lear was about, knowing what Romeo and Juliet about, all of them, having a basic understanding of all of them, or have read Romeo and Juliet? Which would you rather have as a lit teacher? I want that comprehension. I want that broad thing. But the other thing that's really nice is the books.
This is a priori learning.
That's
getting
right.
Getting the general.
That's right.
So then I can.
And so I
do
a lot of
survey
stuff.
Yes.
So yes. And so I always give a question. I say, okay, how are you going to teach Diary of Anne Frank? You going to take 2 years and teach a Diary of Anne Frank? I mean, two weeks? No. What you do is you teach Diary of Anne Frank in one day. You teach a part of it. And at the same time, you just back up. Instead of teaching a unit on Diary of Anne Frank, you teach a unit on the Holocaust literature. So you teach Mein Kampf, you teach Diary of Anne Frank, on and on and on. You teach the Summer of My German Soldier, mm-hmm. those things. But each just an excerpt from it, see?
Another thing that's happening is that your students are then recognizing the vastness of resources.
That's right.
Relative to any area of
that's
learning.
That's right. The other thing is, like I say, the books begin disappearing.
Yeah.
Because there'll be some kids who will like that book, and they will take it home.
Anne Frank doesn't turn me on, but Mein Kampf was fascinating,
okay.
Right?
Right, whatever. And some of the kids will have a different,
sure.
perspective. And so if you teach in 5-day period, if you teach 5 books, the books are going to disappear, because some book kids will like this and some kids will like this, see? And they'll go home and they'll do the reading. But again, they're reading one type of thing during the day from the discipline, and from in the evening, they're expanding it, teaching reading from the other disciplines.
Okay, George Guthridge, we have the foundation, we have memorization, and we have knowledge coming in the foundation of our house. Then we have our walls, which
right.
you've described. Now, what's next?
Okay, well, the next, and notice as we go that we're getting more creative, we're getting more flexible, just like a house is,
mm-hmm.
okay? The next is the interior. The interior walls, you can move them around a little bit, but they're still somewhat in place. I mean, those load-bearing walls have to be at that particular place, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You can only do so many things creatively with the wiring, or you're going to bring your house down. Or on the job, this is where we have performance. Okay, it's the same thing. Okay, we've done the training in step two, now we're in step three in performance. And this is where we teach problem solving. And notice when I was showing you, talking about the teaching of writing, I wasn't just talking about writing. I was talking about thinking. See,
yes.
For me, there's no such thing as creative writing. There's only communicative writing and creative thinking. Okay, I want to teach, I want to get away from attacking the symptoms, whether that's writing or grammar, and I want to go back and attack the problem. I want to attack the disease at its roots. I want to have preventive medicine. Okay, and so what I do is I'm able to show teachers in 1 hour how to teach creative thinking, logic, and writing all at once, because they're all the same process. Okay? And so in step three, you give the kids the scenario, which you've already have in your head, so you've manipulated instruction as you've gone, okay, to get to the scenario. Now they have something to write about. Mm-hmm. And then you have this problem-solving creative process, which I've already outlined. But go back to step two, you've done something else, which I've never seen anybody do. There are three types of writing that are emphasized. We have academic writing, like report writing. We have language experience, also known as personal experience writing. And we have reaction writing, reacting to a film or a book. And I call that emotional experience. Okay. In my program, you have all three experiences going at the same time, like three arrows directed at step three. So when the kids are ready to write, and they've got this formula, which you already, you know, this A, B, C, D, E, you know, name the problem, define, prove it's a problem, etc. Now you really have material to write about, you see. Okay, so now you really can have substance to your writing. Those are your walls.
It sounds like if this building, this structure that you're offering your students functions, the acceleration is eternal. There is no way to stop the education process.
And you can take this, you can say the same thing we're teaching and apply it to daily life. I've had kids decide on their college they were going to attend to by using the same process, for example.
George Guthridge, thank you for a fascinating hour. We have lost something in gaining much, I must say. George and I intended to talk about a second book, but let me conclude by giving you ways to find George Guthridge and his thinking. The first is a book called I Am a Teacher, which was published by Simon & Schuster in what year, George?
The hardback was done in 1988, if I remember right.
Okay. So
Excuse me, 1990. Paperback was this year.
And the paperback in 1992. So that's a book that's findable. You'll find information about George Guthridge and about his theories and practice of reversed instruction. The second way to find Mr. Guthridge is through reversed instruction. It is a book that is hoping to be sold to a publisher in the immediate future, and you should probably find within the next year or so. Now, there is a third way, and that is through a book we were not able to discuss today. It's called Child of the Light. It is a book by George Guthridge and Janet Gluckman. It's part of a four-part series. Child of the Light was published in April of 1992 by St. Martin's Press. A second book should be out within the next couple of months, then the third, then the fourth in the series. This is a book about three people and how they endured the Holocaust. It is a fiction based on fact. I don't often recommend things to my listeners, but I am about three-quarters of the way through, and I'm finding it fascinating. So a number of ways to refer to our guest today and to pick up and take him home, if you will. I'm Susan McInnes. We've spent an hour with George Guthridge. Thanks for listening. George, thanks very much for being with us.
No, you're welcome.
And I hope you join me again next week.